The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
And now we welcome our sister station, Sangeet 106.1 FM and Sky 99.5 FM for the Lunchtime Doctor. Good afternoon to you, Doctor, and welcome.
Good afternoon, Tasca.
Good afternoon.
Pleasure to be here, and good afternoon to everyone locked on and enjoying this Wednesday afternoon now. And today I thought a little bit about where we should carry the conversation, especially before we take in those calls, maybe after 12:30 or so, those messages. I'd love to hear from each and every one of you, your thoughts, your questions, your comments. We really would like to engage with you so that we learn together as a population. And in thinking about today's topic, I'm looking at some recent developments, looking at what's been taking place regionally here in the Caribbean and with our sister island, even in Jamaica, Barbados, these islands. And the real push in the healthcare sector is focusing on these diseases called non-communicable diseases. And it is something that we've mentioned over the many months that we've been on the Lunchtime Doctor, exploring different topics, different conversations. But this is a topic we will have to sing, and we'll have to continue to ventilate and talk about more and more, because there's never anything like, you know, I've learned enough. I know enough about this, and I have all the tools in my tool shed to combat and overcome these diseases. So once again, it's always a privilege to be here sharing these pearls and my experience and my research from this evidence-based standpoint, and also marrying it with what is practical and realistic here in our beautiful island. So in my clinic down in South, I see maybe dozens, 100 plus patients every week. And while everyone's diagnoses are very common, each person's story is very unique. And what I find interesting when I listen is that there's an underlying connection, and the plot is often the same. Many persons, when they come in for these complaints, come in feeling very tired, different symptoms, headaches, a wound won't heal, there's the body's not responding how it should to a virus, and more often than not, all these diagnoses fall under one general umbrella that causes these symptoms, and that is the umbrella of non-communicable diseases. Here in Trinidad and Tobago and around the world, we call them lifestyle diseases. And they are many times a silent disease, like a silent storm, or sometimes, like, you know, we in the Caribbean here, we understand that the weather today may not be what's on the horizon, that's coming on the horizon. So that's why to our forecasters and persons in the weather, we look to the east and we see, hey, there's a storm coming. Similarly, our roles as healthcare providers, doctors, nutritionists, you know, physiotherapists, psychologists, all of the teams, dentists even, we look really to try many times and avoid that situation in the first place, that storm. Now, when we look at the numbers here locally, these NCDs, primarily in the form of heart disease, heart attacks, as we commonly say, hypertension, pressure, diabetes, more commonly known as sugar, and cancer, these four diseases are responsible for over 62% of all deaths in our country. But today I don't want to just focus on statistics and numbers and just these cold mortality statistics. Let us look at the quality of life, because modern medicine is amazing. Modern medicine has advanced in such a way that it is excellent and incredibly good at keeping us alive. In fact, we are living the longest in recorded history due to modern medicine. We have a system that is developed in creating very excellent treatments, medications, advanced surgeries, and not just that, the entire system is designed in a way such as medical records, laboratory testing, diagnostic testing, imaging, and every single part of that structure plays a crucial role in optimizing the health of an individual, a community, and a nation at large. So it's never going to be a one sector, one part solution to improving healthcare. Every single person in this this wheel plays an integral part in improving the health of our population. So similarly, my friend listening on, when you think of your health, you can think of your health as this central hub of feeling great, feeling optimum. You are thriving, you are feeling your best energetic self. All aspects of your life is in working in tandem. But this hub, for those who can picture a bicycle wheel, for instance, this hub that is in the center that keeps our vehicle moving or bicycle moving is connected by many spokes. And these spokes, these things that connect to the outer part of our wheel that moves our life, each one of these aspects of our wheel of health is very, very important. And I want us to remind ourselves of that, that here we must never get too fanatic or sidetracked on any one aspect of the wheel. I've seen a culture in Trinidad over the 15 years of my practice where when we hear one thing, we go down that track and we forget about all the other aspects and the spokes of that life and that wheel of your health. So today I want to touch on some of those spokes and those different aspects of our health and how we can maintain our health with this integrated and holistic approach. So when we talk about sugar and pressure, my friend, we always tend to view the body as this robotic machine and broken into parts, the digestive system, the endocrine system, the muscular system, you know. And if the blood pressure is high, we prescribe a pill to lower it. If the HbA1c or your sugar reading in your blood is elevated, we prescribe medications like metformin. And evidence-based medicine is also finally catching up as well too in what many of these ancient traditions have known for millennia, in that you cannot treat just the physical body alone without addressing all aspects of the human existence, the body, the breath, the mind, and also addressing challenges in the environment. And this is the very heart of what we do, especially many persons do not understand the role of a family physician. A specialist family physician, like myself, is profoundly different from my colleagues who are specialists such as cardiologists, endocrinologists, or incredible surgeons. A specialist in those fields are generally an expert in a system, an organ system, or in some surgical specialty. But as a family physician, we are experts in the person, because the art of family medicine is recognizing that you and I, the patient, sitting in front of us, is not just a collection of lab results. This is a unique story. It is a mother dealing with a stressful job, a father worried about the future of his children, someone carrying grief, loss of a loved one, someone living in isolation, lacking community support. So we don't just treat a diagnosis or the disease, we treat the patient who is experiencing that disease. And to do this effectively, that is where we practice preventive medicine. And this means we look at the whole person, that is the physical, the emotional, the mental, the psychological, and even the spiritual. And this is why the prescription is not just only for medications, but the prescription involves many other things as well. Physiotherapy, nutritional therapy, psychotherapy, recommending social support connections, like building those connections in the community, communities through faith-based organizations and these things. So it means stepping in before the disease takes root. And I'd like you to think a moment about, are we truly waiting for the engine light in our bodies to come on? Are we truly waiting for that knocking sound in our bodies to say, hey, things have gone out of control? Or do we really want to say, let me do my general checkups, let me listen to my body well before these fires and these diseases manifest and come forward, but as a lifestyle disease? And I want to assure you that lifestyle diseases very often, and in fact, very uncommon for it, to suddenly present. These chronic non-communicable diseases usually take decades and years of a lifestyle that is triggering maybe what is already there genetically, or putting these lifestyles that cause our systems to go from ease to disease. And how we treat these conditions is very, very important. Because in any treatment model, especially in my practice, we look at both the pharmacological treatment and the non-pharmacological treatment. My dear friends listening, I'd like to paint a picture to you, all right? We go back to times when it was electricity wasn't there, okay? You have a fire in a wooden home, okay? That is not the time to be talking about, well, let's dig a drain around the home. Let's run a hose and some plumbing. Let's build a tankstan. That is the time, my friends, to call the fire service and actually throw water on the fire. Because if you don't act on it, you are going to lose your home. And it's going to be permanently damaged, if not lost totally forever. So when it comes to medication in Trinidad, I realize we have this great fear of the medication. Many times in my consultation and when I speak to my colleagues, we have great difficulty recommending pharmacotherapy, which is the medications to patients. And this culture comes from many things I've realized. A lot of misinformation, a lot of trust in non-experts or non-qualified individuals. We go to the bars, we go to the wherever, and someone says, you know, I rub coconut oil under my foot and it helped cure my ulcer. Somehow we have a culture of trusting that than going to a healthcare professional and being advised based on evidence. And, you know, when I think about it, it is something that we've grown up in times gone by, or forefathers, trusting elders and trusting seniors in times when we did not have the abundance of resources and networks that we have now, like a robust healthcare system. In fact, we should be very proud of our primary health system, because many places in the world do not have access to primary health centers. And back in the 80s, when the World Health Organization launched the primary health initiatives, our ministers, our healthcare professionals were the ones leading those pretty developments. There's so much so that today we have close to 100 health centers that you can just walk in to talk about your health in this country. And we have to come back to the idea that healthcare and medication isn't something that we should be fearing, and with this animosity and this antagonistic way of thinking. Because when we are dealing with conditions like type 2 diabetes, hypertension, these are where modern medicine has given us powerful tools. And in many instances, these are diseases now that has been out for decades. And medication, like metformin, is brilliant. Because when we know your numbers, when we know your HbA1c levels, we are guided based on the evidence to help your liver in decreasing the production of glucose and increasing your body's sensitivity to insulin. That is something that has a big genetic factor, that each one of us born differently, born from different lineages and genetic makeup compositions, we all have different sensitivities to developing insulin resistance. That is not something that we can suddenly change or decide, oh, we're going to change our genetics today. if anything, that will take generations of effort to reach out our genetic predispositions, okay? Although in the field of stem cell and these genetic research is very, very fascinating. But again, it still is, at this point in time, genetic testing only allows us really to understand what our genetic makeup is, but it also helps in some instances, particularly in cancer, to develop specific treatment at a genetic level based on your composition. Now, coming back to diabetes and this whole idea of insulin resistance. Insulin resistance for some happens very slowly, very long. Persons live until 60s, 70s, and then they develop a slow-growing, slow-proceeding type 2 diabetes. But then there are some persons as early as their 30s, what we call, many times they are changing the names or the way we refer to this onset of diabetes, you know, adolescent onset, maturity onset. But younger and younger, we are seeing persons develop type 2 diabetes. And this has a huge predisposition to do with our genetics, given the modern day lifestyles. And this is where knowing your numbers is very important. Because for anyone with type 2 diabetes, your target HbA1c is less than 7.0%. And the evidence is very clear, you know, there are things that you can do to get this type 2 diabetes under control to the point where that HbA1c goes below 6.5, where you can see that you have managed your diabetes, you are no longer suffering from diabetes, and even to the point where that HbA1c goes below 5.7%, where you can then say you have reversed diabetes. But that, my friends, is not going to be a one-off event. That is going to be an approach that is holistic, that becomes all-encompassing, that includes both the pharmacotherapy and the non-pharmacotherapy options. And this is why things like metformin, which is managing the liver's output when you are diagnosed with diabetes, it gives you the ability to focus on building the tungsten, to focus on building the drains and the waterways and the sprinkler system. Because it'll be very, very foolish and ignorant to think while your house is on fire to start only focusing on building a tungsten. And by the time you finish with the tungsten, the entire home is burnt to the ground. So develop this confidence, Trinidad and Tobago. And trust, develop trust. And to develop trust is a two-way street, of course. So even as healthcare professionals, as doctors, we must stand by the evidence. And you and we as patients, we must also be able to ask about the evidence, question the evidence. You know, doctor, is metformin really proven? Is it, how does it work? Tell me about it. Why are you prescribing this to me? Do you just feel like prescribing metformin to me? Tell me the science behind it. And that is why understanding this, it gives you the ability to understand, you know what? The science shows for persons with diabetes, those who are taking metformin versus those who are not taking metformin, based on some other factors as well too, those without chronic kidney disease and whatnot and tolerance issues, the evidence is very clear that those taking the medications have way less negative outcomes, such as the macrovascular complications and microvascular complications of diabetes, which is things like heart attacks, strokes, kidney failure, you know, amputations, and all the lists of very, very, very debilitating and disruptive complications that occur because of type 2 diabetes. And when we speak about the medications, it's not that we're not focusing on the non-pharmacotherapy. This has to be integrated into your life together with your medications, okay? And this is the non-pharmacological intervention. And this is where things like diet, exercise, stress management, movement, these also help now to start rebuilding and reshaping your body, your endocrine system, your neurological system to get it under control as well. So when we talk about family medicine, I want you to understand that there's a huge difference between a family physician and a GP, and there's a big part of being a family physician is not just writing a prescription, but guiding patients on how to restructure their plate, how to focus on all the spokes on your bicycle wheel. The medication is the bridge to keep you safe in that moment where there is a flood or a fire. And the lifestyle changes that will take time together with your medication eventually becomes the cure. So let me paint how that looks to you. For instance, you may come in to see me. Your HbA1c is 7.5% today. Your blood pressure readings are 150, 145 over 90 consistently. And I sit with you and I say, look, Joe, we really have to get these numbers in an area that isn't going to damage your organs. I'm going to prescribe, based on your history, ACE inhibitor for your blood pressure. And I'm going to prescribe metformin twice a day with another medication, an SGLT2 inhibitor for your diabetes. But the conversation doesn't stop there. The conversation goes on to say, now that we will be using these medications to help bring your body's systems back into some sort of control, the idea is now to focus on your lifestyle changes. Let us speak about your diet. Do we need a dietary input? Let us speak about your physical activity. Are you getting in enough movement, enough exercise into your weekly and daily regimes? What about your stress management? What about your psychological issues? How is your mental health? What is the stresses in your life? And we look at that. And then once you have a non-communicable disease, one of the things I've realized in Trinidad is that persons say, I'll just go to the pharmacy every 3-6 months, collect my prescription. And our colleagues in the pharmacological industry, they do a very good job of advising and making sure that you have all your right medications. There are not any interactions between them. But we lose the idea that you should follow up routinely with your primary care and family doctors. And this is important because in 6 months' time, you come back and you say, Dr. Vasant, I've been checking my blood pressure readings and it's constantly 115 over 70. It's not budging from that at all. And I did my HbA1c 3 months ago and it's now 6.3. I say, that's great news. And you said, look, I've been exercising. I've lost weight naturally without even thinking about it. I just randomly went on the scale after 3 to 6 months and I realized I lost 7-8 pounds. I feel lighter. My body is better. I wake up better. I'm managing my stress better. I'm taking the kids to the park regularly. Life is really going well. And that is where now I sit and I say, yes, let's drop that dosage of that high blood pressure medication from 1 to 1/2. Let's reduce the dosage of the metformin. I'll call you in 2 weeks' time. We'll see how the blood pressure readings and sugar readings are going with this adjustment. Continue your lifestyle changes. Continue to go for your exercise. Speak to the dietitian. And that's when now patients would call and say, doc, it's continuing to stay at 110 over 70. And my fasting blood sugars are consistently 100 to 105. And I'm feeling great. And then we say, okay, continue that again for another 3 to 6 months. And over years may pass. To change lifestyle diseases will never be suddenly in 3 months you've changed what you have done in 30 years. It takes effort. It takes a long time. And maybe after some years of really working on your lifestyle, we can sit and have a conversation and say, yes, it seems like you've reversed your type 2 diabetes. You've reversed your high blood pressure. You've developed now healthcare routine that is optimal and it is maintaining your health and you are now able to come off your medications. But somehow in Trinidad, we don't have that patience. We want everything now. We want everything immediately. And we hear that Moringa works. We say, right, all day, all night is Moringa, Moringa, Moringa. And this time the blood sugars are going high. And as we say, we turn a blind eye to the numbers. Okay. So we reach 12:30 on the program this afternoon. Always, I hope that it's thought-provoking, stimulating, leaving some food for thought, literally. Maybe you're chewing on that meal as I always say, chew your food 32 times mindfully. Yeah.
And we do have some a few questions there, Doc. Good afternoon.
Lovely to hear your voice. Let's get those questions.
All right, first question. Can metformin cause cancer and kidney failure?
This is a great question, Biz. You know, many persons, I know where the misconception came in. When persons reach the stage of kidney disease, which is like stage 4 and stage 5, that means that your EGFR, the rate at which your kidneys is filtering or filtrating the proteins such as creatinine in your body, that's where you would be heading towards dialysis. And the number one cause of damage to your kidneys are these high blood pressure and diabetes, these two factors. And many persons would hear that, well, when somebody have to go on dialysis or they have kidney failure, they will hear the doctor say, okay, you can't use metformin or you should not use metformin, or they will stop the patient from using metformin. And I've realized people misunderstood that or misinterpreted that to think that metformin caused the kidney failure. Metformin, on the other hand, actually is the medication that prevents and delays the onset of kidney failure in patients with diabetes. So metformin, as a matter of a profound statement, does not cause kidney failure. And it is there no evidence whatsoever that metformin causes any form of cancer. In fact, we put so many other toxins and poisons into our body that cause cancer, cigarette, tobacco, alcohol, all these carcinogenic microplastics and these things, and poor lung and air quality that are very proven to be cancer causing as compared to the medications that we take. All right, great question there.
Off topic here. Excellent program. Kudos to the doctor. Can stem cells help with Parkinson's disease?
Great question. I think we touched on stem cells last time I was live on air. And stem cell is really exciting for the future of healthcare, especially with integrating things like AI and the way in which technology can start mapping cells and where these cells originate from, especially when it comes to cancer treatment, because cancer usually is a tumor of an individual germline or cell line. So stem cell therapy is actually very helpful right now in cancer treatment. But when we talk about Parkinson's disease, this is a disease that, you know, we always go back to the boxer and these things like that. There are standard therapies where we prescribe medications like levodopa that manage the symptoms by replenishing the dopamine in the brain and neurochemical pathways. Stem cell therapy aims to be disease modifying. So that goes to the dead or dying cells or neurons to restore natural brain function. So while I'm no expert in that area, I know of Parkinson's disease and how we treat it here locally. And researchers are primarily exploring how these stem cells can basically, you have stem cells that can go into any cell in the body, and then you have stem cells that are found in specific areas of the body, like your bone marrow and your neurons and stuff like that. So the current trials, from my understanding, is exploring how these stem cells can work at the neuronal level. So can there be ways that we can change the neurons by editing or treating at the stem cell level? So what it means is, like, for instance, let's say, you know, like a baby in the womb, that baby has a lot of stem cells and it's growing and multiplying. So using embryonic stem cells is a possibility of this growing into very healthy neurons that are not designed in a way to be that dopamine triggered, shaking Parkinsonism type as well. So there's no current evidence on approved use of stem cell treatments for Parkinsonism, as far as I'm aware. But it's very promising and it's very exciting that the research is currently undergoing in this regard. Yeah, great question.
All right, another question coming here. Of course, a lunchtime doctor. Feel free to call us up at 625-2257, 627-3223. You could also message us at 306-1065. And also you can message our friends at Sangeet and Sky, and they will send us your messages to us right here in studio. Good day, doctor. I sometimes feel a chill, sometimes very cold during the course of the day, even when it's hot. Do you know what's wrong with me?
That's a great question. I laugh at it because chills and then say, what's wrong with me? And it's very fascinating. It's fun being a physician because, you know, we're very diagnostic. So just last Sunday, I was cutting some grass and I sat in the company of 8 other wonderful gentlemen. So they were talking about cars and cars in the days of, you know, the 280Cs and the 120Y and the engine and how long ago persons knew their cars inside out, especially carburetor engine on a Sunday. Persons would be able to say, yes, I'm hearing this sound here coming from my exhaust. That's a carburetor problem. That's an air filter problem. This loss of power here is a little spark plug problem, a coil pack problem. And to me, why I bring that story up now is that when someone comes to us like, you know what, I'm having a symptom, doc, figure it out. It's never going to be that one symptom that tells us, you know. It's going to be other follow-up things because a chills can be many things. Chills could be just simply feeling cold because you are in a cold environment in your office and you're working in corporate TT and they're blasting that AC. And it could be to something very sinister, very, very, health conditions that show that, there are underlying reasons, metabolic, physiological, endocrine, or infectious causes of these chills. So your chills are the body's way of rapidly creating heat through these rapid, quick-firing muscle contractions. And they are most commonly associated with a rise in fever. So if this is a chronic thing, certainly you want to get that checked out. Sometimes, though, when you do develop like the flu, early stages of the flu, upper respiratory tract infections, you can develop these chills. But there are other serious illnesses, dengue fever, and that can cause daytime chills and these rigors. So once you have a symptom like that, firstly, monitor, get your temperature checked, and get to a healthcare professional. And there's a whole long way of looking at what could be causing this, from endocrine to infectious to blood to neurological, you name it. It's a symptom that goes across diagnoses. Yeah.
That's it for questions for now.
Great, yeah, you know, and listening on, I always admire these questions, and so many persons, so many of you would run into me and ask these questions as well. And many times I encourage persons, ask questions, because you might be thinking, this is unique to you, but it brings about an answer that helps many, many other persons in their daily lives.
All right, I have another one. Does over 30 years using statins cause dementia? What is the best statin to take for lowering cholesterol?
Yeah, great question as always. Over 30 years, you know, look, genetics, let's come back to this genetics question, thing about diseases like lifestyle diseases, non-communicable diseases. Many persons, especially when it comes to cholesterol, it's because there's a big familial or genetic link to developing cholesterol. You would have persons as early in their 20s just eating healthy, exercising, living a very good life. And when we check their fasting lipid profile and panel, their LDLs or their triglycerides are extremely high. That's why the latest American recommendations for the cholesterol is to check, even as a teenager, your cholesterol readings, especially because there's this genetic predisposition with, if I remember correctly, apolipoprotein B, that persons who are having heart attacks in their 30s, having heart attacks in their 40s, they have this genetic predisposition, and these lipoproteins, apolipoprotein, is usually very high in there. So using statin comes by when a physician looks at your, not just your profile, your panel, but your risk factor for a heart attack or a stroke. So when we say using statins, I'm not sure if the question came that from the age of 30 or after 30 years.
Yeah, they said does over 30, well, over 30. Let's just say it does over 30.
Yeah, I assume it's over 30 years of age and not over 30 years of using it, right? But over 30 years of age, statins don't just stop new cholesterol from sticking to the arterial walls. They actively change the composition of the existing plaques. So what that means is that if you start cholesterol medications, it makes the core of the plaque denser, calcified, less likely to rupture, because it is a ruptured plaque that causes the sudden heart attacks or stroke. And we have actually based, here's one, we have studies that have been going on for more than 2 to 3 decades looking at the effectiveness and the effect of these statin medications. Is what we, one of the medications, statins, metformins, are some of the medications where we have what we call the legacy effect. We have seen patients who take statins early and consistently, especially with those who are at risk factors, high risk factors, they enjoy a persistent reduction in their cardiovascular outcomes and mortality that extends for decades. Even if, so what it's saying is that, let's say you start at the age of 30, you went to the doctor, you have a strong family history, you have a sibling, a father, someone who had a heart attack or a stroke at a very young age, we did your cholesterol levels, it is high, you have a little bit of prediabetes, we say, yes, we're going to prescribe a statin for you. By starting statin at that stage, you are actually preventing death from an earlier age, you are preventing heart attacks and strokes over the next 30 years. And even after those 30 years, the adherence, even, you don't need to be as adherent to the medication because you've been taking it for such a long time. So statins are among the most intensely studied drugs in the history of modern day medicine and pharmacotherapy, and their multi-decade long safety profile is generally very excellent through a few, though there are a few specific things that we would look out for and monitoring. And usually, just so that everyone is, there is some muscle symptoms that some persons may experience, statin-associated muscle symptoms. And but generally, persons who take the statin after a year, they will continue to tolerate it for over 30 years. And then, of course, liver function. We as family doctors and all specialists, we routinely monitor the liver statins because of these fears of a gradual liver damage. But the current data shows that after 30 years of studying these statins, there could be a mild elevation of the liver enzymes in just 1 to 2% of patients. They almost never cause any liver failure or chronic liver failure. So routine monitoring is no longer recommended by major societies for the liver disease, especially if you've been taking it for a long time. So yeah, and then the question did include which one is the best. That's a unique question, and each one of us are unique. So sometimes your triglycerides may be higher, sometimes your genetic composition might be different. And as physicians, we look at some these small nuances and say, right, you know, maybe the rosuvastatin for this person who has let's say more high triglycerides, and let's say the simvastatin for someone who doesn't have that triglyceridemia, and we use that. It's also based on availability many times as well. We're very practical that you can get your medication to begin with as well, okay?
All right, I see we do have a call on the line. Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Pinal here.
Yes,
I found that I was diabetic about 19, 20 years ago. And I took the position that I'm going to defeat this, and my wife was very supportive. You are not uneducated like one of your cousins who had passed away. At the time, he was just 5 years, well, you know, he was 5 years older than me. so, but I had gone past the age of his death. And so I started looking at YouTube videos and buying some books and so on by legitimate doctors who were in practice and who had gone to medical school and they had written books and media videos and whatnot. And that worked for me. And a lot of the information that I got there is basically about diet and exercise and taking your medication. And I've tried to pass this on, but I'm not a doctor, so I have to be very careful because sometimes people believe in you and you have to be very circumspect in what you say. But I do not get the feeling that our doctors here propagate diet and exercise as a first line of defense. They mention to get some exercise and eat more vegetables. That's what I got. That's definitely not enough. As a teacher, I can tell you, you're not getting the message across with that. I want your opinion, so thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Pinal. And we must hold ourselves in any position that we hold in life to be under scrutiny, to have reflection and see where we can improve. And I want to agree with you in many parts in that information is important, that if we only as healthcare providers have a consultation and at the end of the consultation, the patient leaves just only trusting us, they're not going to any other healthcare providers. And they simply think that for my diabetes, all I need to do is take my metformin and that's it. That there is not a good result. And I totally agree with you there, Mr. Pinal. And the reason that we always complain of these issues and challenges in healthcare models is that good healthcare models need to be multidisciplinary. And we need to move away from this egocentric way of administering health in that I, Dr. Basdeo, is the one and be it all, and I will cure your diabetes and there's nothing else. You just need to listen to me, okay? That is where we blur the lines between professionalism and these personal egocentric things. And that's why a good doctor would recognize, look, I totally understand the physiology, the biochemistry, the way in which your disease is working on your system. I know exactly the type of medication based on your numbers, based on my examination findings that you need, whether it's a SGLT2 inhibitor, metformin, you name it. We know how to prescribe that. And yes, I do agree that many times I do encounter patients or persons in corridor conversation saying, I haven't really been recommended these other forms of treatments. And it's not that they're alternative, but they're complementary and integral or integrated parts of the healthcare model. So I agree, we need to focus on having physicians and healthcare providers being able to, outside of their specialties, whether it's, you are a psychologist, whether you are a dietitian, whether you are a physician, to be able to say, the recommendation is lifestyle treatment as well, as part of the prescription, and I would like to prescribe physical exercise. In fact, that's something that I do in the clinic, that I was trained by our esteemed professors out of the Faculty of Medical Sciences here in University of West Indies, to prescribe exercise, where we sit with the individual, we go through what you do. You might be a swimmer, you might be a cycler, a jogger, you might have mobility issues, and we prescribe for the week a routine, a regime, as exercise, as movement, for that lifestyle. The diet is something that depends on the physician, on the healthcare provider, that they may or may not be too versed in, but it is a part of our training and education as well. And that is where our nutritionists and dietitians come in. They would sit with you in a separate consultation now to really sit, meal plan, look at your calorie intake, look at your fiber intake, and truly come up with a plan that complements all the other treatments that is taking place for your lifestyle disease. Mm-hmm. Great call, as always, Mr. Pinal. Always a pleasure to hear from you.
Thank you.
Experience.
Mm-hmm. All right, okay. What about the person with the statins was talking about dementia? What about dementia? Did we touch on that?
Dementia, there's been a public, I realize there's a growing concern about that there might be a link between cholesterol or treating cholesterol, statins, and dementia. And again, extensive long-term studies, and these are studies that is not just today, it's been going for many decades, they have found no causal link between statin use and an increased risk of dementia or cognitive decline. In fact, it's quite the opposite, because many persons, just recently, I've had an individual very dear to me, just having some symptoms, and we decided, let's do a CT scan of the brain. And the CT scan showed that the individual had many old infarcts, or what we call strokes. So there's something called lacuna infarcts. A lacuna means very tiny vessels in the brain. And these are known as microstrokes. And you would find that having these microstrokes, these lacuna infarcts, do increase your risk of dementia, and it decreases your cognitive function. So by taking your statin medication, by taking your and maintaining your lipid readings to a level that is known to be protective of your arteries and your vessels, you are preserving the blood flow to your brain, preventing these microstrokes, and long-term statin use is actually being, on the other hand, studied for protective effect against vascular dementia. What they're saying is that if you have a genetic or a history of dementia in your family, or at risk of developing dementia, the statins are actually protective against developing vascular dementia particularly. You know, bottom line is, to that question, patient using statins, the medication is there for so long. It's not one of the medications that are new, and it's not just now in clinical trials. That's something in my clinical practice and experience now. I'm very a bit apprehensive when new things are coming out, especially after trials are very brand new, or the trials aren't done in populations, let's say, that are reflective of our beautiful Trinbegonian rainbow type genetic disposition. I usually take those research and trials recommendations coming out of countries where they don't represent us truly, and let some time pass as well to more trials, more research. And that's why a good healthcare provider is evidence-based. We continue to research the literature. It's not fun. I do not like reading all these papers and getting all these summaries and staying up to date with what the recent recommendations are. Look, just recently, the NICE guidelines are those guidelines out of the UK. They've made a very bold statement about treating diabetes and how we initiate treatment. Usually, we would recommend metformin as the medication to start treatment for patients with uncontrolled type 2 diabetes within a certain category, within a certain kidney health function. Now they're saying to start the metformin with the SGLT2 inhibitors, as this is proven to be cardioprotective, reducing the risk for heart attacks, reducing the risk for heart failure, reducing the risk for kidney failure as well. So evidence continues to evolve, continues to grow as medicine. That is the strength of the healthcare system, that as the evidence grows, the literature grows, the research grows, we can continue to push the human existence into more and more healthy living, healthy options, particularly against the things that are taking away our lives and our loved ones from us prematurely.
That's it for questions. I'll leave it to wrap it up.
Thanks, Beast. And you know, look, my friends listening on health, how do we really get our population, ourselves included, to get that motivation, to get that inspiration, to say, you know, before in front take me, let me take in front when it comes to our health. The evidence is there. You know, we would come on the programs there. If you look all over the internet and social media, there will be these pearls that is highlighting how important our health is. And when we really reflect, we continue to say, you don't have a problem until you have a health problem. Because you would think all your problems are such intense, and oh man, you consider all these deadlines and all these things that are worrying you, stressing you out. But really put yourself on a bed in any one of the hospitals. Really put yourself on a wheelchair. Really put yourself, you know, being dependent on someone to look after you. And ask yourself, do I do I want to be there? One, and I don't think any one of us would want to be there. And if I am there, how can I improve my health? How can I maintain my health? And this, my friends, is where you have to develop this motivation that I can and I shall and I will to say, from today, I'm going to get more active. I'm going to move. The evidence is clear. Persons who spend 150 minutes a week and more, not just a minimum, they tend to have less health outcomes that are negative, right? Persons who eat a healthy diet, a diet rich in fibers, rich in those low glycemic index foods, good balanced meals, balanced plates, they tend to have a lot better outcomes as well with their health. Persons who manage their stress, persons who prioritize and optimize their sleep, and finally, those who control their existing diseases by taking their medications and knowing your numbers. Many moons ago, there was a Know Your Numbers campaign by the Ministry of Health. And I thought this to be fantastic because so many of us are walking around right now listening to this program and you don't know what your blood pressure readings are in the last 6 months. You don't know what your blood sugar, random blood sugar reading has been in the last 3 months or 6 months. And that's why, you know, there are so many health fairs. You know, I'll be at a health fair at Girl City Mall on Saturday. Just pop in, just say hello and get your blood pressure checked, your blood sugar checked. And when it comes to weight as well, we're moving away from this idea that it's about a number, but it's about a feeling. It's about how do you carry your body? How do you move your body? It's about different body types. It's not about a specific number, one size fits all for everyone. Not just your weight or your BMI, but what's that abdominal circumference? You know, that sign of good living as long time, as the people would say, as older generations say. You know, that pot belly, hey, that man doing well. But that is actually a very negative, you know, we use the word negative. It's not a good indicator of health, especially when that abdominal circumference or that truncal obesity is a lot wider than our hips and or bigger or more greater in size than our hip circumference as well. So that abdominal circumference, the hip ratio is very, very important as well. So to everyone listening out in our beautiful Twin Island Republic, start today, you know, just hearing this, let this motivate you, inspire you, that look, whatever happened in the past, that's in the past. We can't change that now. But from today, starting very small, we're going to make a nice routine, a ritual, simple as getting up and watching the sunrise. That is part of health. Simple as, you know, on an evening, you're taking 5 minutes just to disconnect, take off your phone, well, not take it off, move away from your phone, move away from devices, and just sit and watch the sunset, listen to the birds. All these things help with your health, managing your cortisol, managing your stress, and listen, prioritize. I see so many times patients come into the office when the numbers have gone against their favor, and that is the time suddenly we find all the motivation, all the time that you don't think you have right now to focus on your health. Suddenly, when a health issue happens, we are able to focus on your health. So to everyone listening, it's always a pleasure being here, sharing these pearls and these evidence-based wisdom with you all. And again, I continue to encourage you to take charge of your health. And you are wealthier than you think, especially for those who are prioritizing their health. So stay blessed, Trinidad and Tobago. And catch you on another edition of the Lunchtime Doctor.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.